Hey, thanks for joining us on Code Chat. My name is Jeremy Foster. You can find me online at codefoster.com or on Twitter at codefoster. And joining me today is Ben, how do I say your last name,
Goddard.
Yeah. Ben Goddard, thanks for joining me.
Yeah, no problem.
All right. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself and how long you've been working at Microsoft and what kind of projects you work on?
Yeah, definitely. So my name's Ben. I started work at Microsoft about, it'll be 3 years in December. Before that, I used to work for the National Security Agency. I currently work on the Office 365 Red Team. Part of what I do is, it's kind of like that show on, I think it was on Discovery Channel or something, it's like To Catch a Thief, where they get someone who knows how to break into a house to come in and show the owners like what to protect.
Interesting.
That's what they do. I mean, that's what we do. We end up breaking in and showing them what to protect against.
Well, that's really awesome. And you call yourselves the Red Team, huh?
Yeah.
And that's positioned against, is there another team?
Yeah, there's a blue team that's supposed to catch us. It's kind of based on the way the military does things.
Okay.
You can't always practice against your real enemies.
Okay.
And so you'll have people who their whole idea is to get into the head of, you know, who the enemy is.
Okay.
And then try to do the same tactics they would do.
So you think like and act like an enemy for your daily job.
Yeah, yeah. It's pretty cool.
Are the red and blue teams also based somewhat on the Halo?
I don't think so, but
no.
Maybe the Halo is based off of the red and blue team from like the military.
Okay, that's
I don't know.
You
probably
cool.
have to ask someone from.
All right. Well, what can you tell us about like what is your strategy? What kinds of efforts do you take to try to? You're trying to break into Office 365,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
Okay.
So a lot of what we'll do is we don't assume. What kind of makes our job differently is, since we're not the ones who built it, we don't take anything for granted. So
okay.
just recently, I was doing something with certificates where there's a certain way that certificates are supposed to work for smart cards, and there's a way to set it up so that it all works. And so I did that on my own, and then I started saying, well, how could this go wrong? Like, how could I start writing my own smart cards certificates and have the system accept it? And so it's one thing to understand from like a functional idea, oh, this is how it works and this is what I need to watch for, but it's different to have someone actually take advantage of your setup and use it against you and then show, because there's definitely some things you can watch for. There's definitely some things you can do in Windows to lock that stuff down and say,
mm-hmm.
well, it all came down to I started putting my own certificate on machines that if you just watch for that, then you can see it right away and catch it. So it's a lot of that getting down deep into how things really work
mm-hmm.
and then leveraging that to do things that people aren't expecting. It's
yeah. It seems absolutely critical because I know as a developer, I usually end up following the happy path in my app and assuming, well, if everything works out like this, it's going to work exactly as I expect. And it's always an extra step to even go down that unhappy path at some point and say, well, what if they attempt to break it this way? And then to take it the extra level and say, what if they're malicious and they're trying to break it by, you know, using any known techniques or anything that wasn't even, you know, I wasn't even thinking about when I made it and they're trying to get in. Seems like you need a third party that's thinking about that angle.
Exactly. Like, it's good what you said about the happy path. It's also we kind of assume, we take an assumed breach standpoint
mm-hmm.
where it's now in the game, there's really no service who can say that they're unbreachable. If you're allowing anyone in, even just the engineers you're expecting, those people could do something bad or they could be taken advantage of through something else. And so the idea is assume a bad guy's gonna get in
okay.
and then what can you do to catch them while they're using that? And so some of that stuff like the happy path, how do you change passwords? How do you change certificates? Like my situation, I got in, it's great to think, oh, well, this is a possibility, but the next step is, okay, if this happens or when this happens, how do we fix it all? How do we
okay.
revert to that? Like when you're building something in code, whether it's, you know, a password or some kind of authentication, you should always be thinking about, okay, well, what do I do to roll this password or roll this certificate or what is that trust based on so that I can always roll, like I'm not dependent. You know, no one wants something hard-coded that's like the essential piece that
mm-hmm.
once that goes wrong or if that goes wrong, you can't fix it without, you know, forcing everyone to reinstall stuff.
So maybe we could draw an analogy here, take the concept into the analog world and assume that we have a building and we're trying to keep people out that aren't authorized. We can assume they're gonna be able to get in the building. I mean, worst case scenario, they could ride right on the back of somebody else with an access card, or it could even be somebody we supposedly trust that's coming in with authorization.
Exactly.
Now they're in the building. How do we treat that? How do we what? Follow them around? How do we record what they're doing? How do we protect things even supposedly within our...
It's like putting, and then you'd have to decide, well, do I want to put locks on all the doors inside? Like, do I just trust it? Once someone's in the building, they're just allowed to do whatever they want? Or, and like you said, are you keeping some kind of record or some kind of log so that you can go back later and say, okay, we thought this was the guy who was coming in the building, but when we look at what he's done, this we need to be able to ask him and say, hey, look, is this... Another big thing, too, is sometimes, well, a common tactic that hackers do is masquerading. If I can act like someone else, you know, using their credentials or their personality, then it looks a lot less suspicious. Because maybe that guy's allowed to do this stuff anyway, but if I'm doing that when that guy's on vacation or when he's really not, like he has no work order, there's no reason why he should be doing this thing that technically he has the permission to do it, that's a good check, too, as well. You know, it's like someone coming in on the weekend. You should say, yeah, this person has access to the building, but on the weekends, it should be locked down. We should figure out why this guy is in the building on the weekend.
That seems like an argument for keeping all the permission, you know, the theory of least permission.
Exactly.
You know,
somebody least
privilege. There you go. Shouldn't have rights unless they absolutely need it for a certain reason.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's always easier to grant people additional rights than it is to take them away.
Yeah.
So if you just let everyone have full access in your environment, then it's really hard to figure out, first of all, who's supposed to be doing what they're doing, and second of all, how to be able to mitigate and control that, and basically isolate pieces off while you try to kick out the attacker.
Now I'm going to make an assumption that in today's world, there are a lot more services, there's a lot more software as a service running at massive scale. Can I assume that this effort of trying to avoid breaches, trying to handle breaches intelligently, trying to mitigate the consequences and trying to learn from breaches, is this a growing concern? Is this something that's getting, you know, pretty huge?
Oh yeah, definitely. Especially it's like, maybe you used to be able to believe that your building will never catch on fire, and so you're just gonna make fireproof walls or whatever, but that doesn't exist in today's environment. And so what you really need to be doing is having a fire drill, you know, regularly, and be able to have a plan of how to evacuate the building in the best way possible. Or in this case, how do we recover from something? How do we recognize when something's going wrong?
Yeah.
And don't take anything for granted.
That's pretty interesting. The show here, Code Chat, is the audience is primarily developers, and let's assume that some of these developers are young. They're just beginning in programming, or maybe just beginning in school, and some of them are pursuing degrees in what would you call the study of all of this?
That's a good question, actually. What I got my degree in was computer engineering.
Okay.
So that I would get the computer science part of it and the engineering.
Oh, interesting.
But I haven't really seen any majors where it's specifically how do you break into something or how do you defend. I also got a master's from Johns Hopkins at in security informatics.
Okay.
But I would say the most important thing is have a solid understanding of how computers work.
Okay.
Because I think the best hackers are the best programmers.
Okay.
Because they really understand the fundamentals of why things don't work and why, like bugs. Bugs are the lifeblood of understanding how to get into something and how to break it. It's finding that gray area or that piece in between where something was designed to work and how it actually works in real life, or how you can get it to do what you want it to do. It's the whole tinkering aspect, that whole, how do I get this thing to, in fact, even the maker movement now that people are kind of following is part of that, I think, as well, that itch to say, well, I know this is what, you know, everyone else is doing, but how can I get this thing to do something that no one expected?
That's very geeky, right?
Yeah, very geeky. It scratches that geeky itch.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, I know that there are degrees in that are specific to cryptography and encryption and cybersecurity and stuff like that. And I imagine any of those would be pretty well suited.
Oh yeah, definitely. I think at Johns Hopkins we had to take some pretty solid crypto classes and stuff. Because that's another thing, understanding, you know, at one level you can abstract it when you're programming because you don't have to worry about the underlying part. You can just trust.
Yeah.
You know, Windows is going to do its thing. But the more if you have a penchant for that, or if you really have a desire to understand how that stuff works, getting down into the details of what is really going on, you can figure out how to best either exploit it or protect it. I think I should also say, though, one of the most important things is don't break the law. Like, it's really hard to get this kind of job if the company cannot trust you.
Yeah.
And so finding the right way to either tinker on your own stuff, like there's the ways to figure out how things work without getting into trouble.
Yeah.
You don't have to break into someone else's computer and break the law to say, oh, now I know how this works.
Yeah.
You can, like sysinternals or the Windows internals books are huge in understanding all the intricacies about Windows and how to be able to do what you want to do without necessarily getting, you know, caught.
And that's a classic.
Yeah.
That's a really an exciting charter, I think, to learn the tools and the skills and the know-how to supposedly be able to break into systems, but to, you know, like you, like Luke, use it for good and not evil, right?
Yeah, exactly. In fact, I think I was mentioning to you earlier that it actually makes me a better programmer now, because like I was doing something totally different where I just wanted to protect the communication, and I'm already thinking about like, oh well, you know, if I just let you type the password in the clear, you know, like think about a lot of apps people are writing now where they're tying into other services and you have to make decisions like, am I saving the password locally? Am I going to use some better kind of authentication like OAuth or some way where I don't require the user to give me too much information because then now I'm responsible for that? Mm-hmm. Those kind of things, I think, I wasn't really thinking about until I started figuring out how it can go wrong. And so now it makes me a better programmer to say, I mean, sometimes it actually makes my programming process a lot longer because it becomes almost over-engineered. But at the same time, I feel confident that I'm at least making it better than just, you know, the first thing you would think.
So the happy path is the shorter path.
It definitely. And in fact, a lot of times, in fact, most of the examples you see online, it's the happy path.
Yeah.
To see what's the quickest path to get things working. And hopefully people start thinking in terms of, well, what's the safest happy path that I can do?
Now, I know that the Windows operating system and modern apps do quite a bit to try to keep the user safe, give the user this sense of security that they can trust this app. If they can trust this app developer, that they know what this app is or isn't going to be able to do through things like the capabilities. But then that only goes so far, right? Because it's pretty easy for an app developer to request, for instance, rights to your document library, and it's pretty easy for your average Joe to install an app and say, sure, fine, whatever.
Exactly. Yeah, nothing's foolproof. There's no silver bullet, but I think what's great about the app environment is you're forming a communication with the user to say, you know, I am going to use your webcam, I am going to use the internet. And so if it's something that you're not expecting, you'd say, how come this game needs my webcam, you know, that kind of stuff. That is nice. I mean, but of course, I would say as an attacker, nothing is unbreakable.
Yeah.
But it's definitely a better world than we had before, where, I mean, people would download stuff from the internet and have no idea that it was a Trojan or it was a backdoor that would let people into their computers because they thought they were getting some free, you know, shareware program.
Do you have any other fun stories from the Red Team that you're able to share with us?
I don't know. I think most of it sounds cooler. Like at the end, a lot of it is just frustration of like, it's like the Edison thing, like finding 1,000 ways that things don't work
and then
finding that one way that no one's thought of. Like it's cool to, I feel better when I can see things get better because of it.
Yeah.
Like it's not enough to just say, hey, look, you know, I was able to do X or whatever, but to be able to work with developers and say, hey, look, you know, this is something that was maybe really hard to do, but still is not on anyone's radar.
Yeah.
And if you just, you know, look for these signs, you'll recognize when someone like me comes in again and starts doing this stuff. And it puts us in a really good situation.
Yeah, that's pretty great. Okay, so now I've talked with you offline about the app that you've been working on and actually recently put into the store, right?
Yeah.
Can you tell us real briefly about that?
Yeah, it's called Completely Relative. It has nothing to do with hacking. It's about genealogy, actually. It's a way, I'm thinking of it, it was kind of, the idea came from the contacts list in Windows 8.
Okay.
About how I could bring in several sources like LinkedIn and Facebook. And I said, oh, wouldn't it be great if I could do that with my ancestors? So I can pull in, the app lets you pull in, import resources from different sources and see them all in one place and be able to turn those sources on and off so that, because sometimes you'll get conflicting reports. Mm-hmm. Like you'll say, you know, my great-great-grandfather, in one place it says he was born in this year and somewhere else has this other detail, and you can be able to compare that and basically keep track of all that in one place. So
that's pretty great.
I like it. Yeah. it was doing my own research on my family. I realized how it was definitely a need I had to be able to keep track of stuff. In fact, I think at one point I had just like a notepad that I was just writing references down in a library, and then I lost the piece of paper. And so being able to, the idea of having it on something portable, you know, like an 8-inch tablet even, and I can just keep track of that. And also search too, like it's neat to be able to import all my ancestors and then type in my name and just see how many of my ancestors have my same name or like my sister's name or something like that.
How about visualizations of relationships and trees?
That's kind of cool too, yeah. I like the being able to just see that all at once. I mean, typically people have just shown like family tree type, like a pedigree chart.
And,
I'm working on some in future releases, different visualizations, but just being able to filter out and sort by name and source and that kind of stuff, and getting details about, you know, time periods where people have lived and stuff. It's a lot of data, and it's neat to be able to manage that with my hands. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
to be able to just, to not have a boring, you know, keyboard type, you know, only interface, to be able to, I like the fluidness, especially like the zoom out view or the semantic zoom. That's really nice to be able to see, because I can get to people really quickly.
Yeah, I love the hub model that we have on the phone and on Windows 8, and how it's kind of, it feels like it's virtualizing. It's taking these sources and it's bringing it up to a virtual address book that I don't have to assemble and maintain. It's pulling from my LinkedIn and my Twitter and my Facebook and all of my social services, as well as all of the information I want to store manually.
Exactly.
And I got excited about your app because I love the idea of just one more of the spokes in this hub to be my past and to be pulling back.
Oh yeah.
You know.
Yeah, that's actually a really good idea, is to add that as one of the sources that could.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's another thing I love about the whole environment, is the fact that, like, I didn't have to do search on my own. Like, it's a global search now, just by doing that contract. And also now you can import and export to my app. And like, I'm like a first party now to like some of the really good apps, like OneDrive and stuff. So.
Yeah, I like that too. As soon as a person's made the choice that this app is valuable for me, I want this on my machine, all of a sudden on their machine, it acts like a first party service. It acts like a first party app,
It's a pretty big thrill to have something I wrote be like a first party service on people's machines.
So. Yeah, I always say it's annoying when I'm ready to share something and I, you know how you see a website and there's like 74 different social services and 73 of them I don't even care about?
Yeah.
and then you know that when the next social service comes out, they're going to have to update their website and add this other social service, because, you know, that's just where we're at these days. Well, on my Windows 8 device, I don't have to worry about that, because maybe I just install two or three that I care about. And then when I share whatever, a news article, those are the only ones I see. I don't have to worry about all these ones I don't use.
I also like how it remembers the last thing. Like, there's certain people in my life that I email stuff to regularly, and now they're just at the top of the list. And now, like, from any app I'm in, if it has that share part enabled, I can just share that out. And that's great, especially for my app, because, you know, it's a family thing. So, like, a lot of the stuff I email are members of my family.
Yeah,
and now
totally.
we can work on stuff together and say, hey, look what I just found, and email it to each other.
Great-great-grandpa just shared a tweet.
Yeah, well, great-great-grandfather's probably dead, but yeah.
So you've got all this experience with security, and you've got this experience making a modern app. Do you have any advice for folks that are making apps on how to make their apps secure, how to make considerations in the security realm that are important for them?
That's a good question. I've actually not faced a lot of stuff that I was worried about in writing the Windows 8 app. And because of the thing we talked about, that it's kind of like in a sandbox, and you kind of subscribe. The biggest thing, I think, is the privacy. I didn't realize that was such a big deal. Like, if you give your app access to the internet, then we assume that there is some kind of information that's being collected, whether it's just IP address and stuff like that. And so that's why the Windows Store requires that you have a privacy policy for that. And I think that is pretty cool, especially today's age, where people really want to know what their data is being used for.
Yeah.
I don't mind people using my data for stuff if I know what it is, and so that's important, I think.
Yeah, I guess a classic app, you know, you'd see it you'd download it and install it, and then you could turn on a little sniffer and you could watch that it actually is communicating with the web, but otherwise you'd have no idea whether it is or isn't, right?
Yeah, in fact, that is a funny story. Like, when I was first learning about this stuff, like, one of the biggest things is once you start understanding how to break into things, you start getting really paranoid. And so I started sniffing on my own network, yeah. and I got really paranoid because there was an open connection that I was like, I've been hacked, like this is that. And it was, I think it was a BitTorrent client that just keeps, it had just kept something open, even though it wasn't running, it was a background channel that was open to just see what the next head was. And so I wasn't hacked, but it was like, but it was that whole thing. I had no idea that it kept a connection open when it was off.
Everybody wants to be in your tray, don't they?
Yeah. And even that, I think that one wasn't even in the tray. I think it was a service that it just installed in the background. And it made it snappy. Like it was, I have no problem with it if I know what it's, like once I figured out what it was doing, it's not like I uninstalled the app
or
the application. It's just scary
just
when you
so
don't
you know
why. Exactly. It's scary when you don't expect that.
Cool. Okay, well, let's go ahead and wrap it up. It's been really good talking to you, Ben. It's fun learning about the security stuff. It's fun learning about the red team here and all the stuff that you do there. And it's also fun talking about your app. So thanks for joining us.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks for having me.
And thanks for tuning in to this episode of Code Chat. And we'll see you next time.